I think my life is about to get back to normal. I've been in trial for a month or so, and that has kept me occupied, working, as they say, 7 days a week. And then, of course, had a lot of preparation before that. I celebrated getting out of trial by participating in a 3.5-hour conference call last Monday morning. Hard to hear. I sat sort of scrunched over in my chair for that length of time trying to get close to the phone. And I celebrated the end of that with an attack of sciatica. Got up out of my chair and just nearly fell to the floor. It was quite painful, and I tried something I'd never tried before. I had never, ever gone to a chiropractor. And somebody said a chiropractor can help that. It helped me and mine. And I was at the point where I think, in spite of Saul's experience, I would have gone to the Witch of Endor. But I did go to the chiropractor, and it helped, and I'm going back in the morning.
To the witch or to the chiropractor?
Take your choice. Eric has taught the last two Sundays. It actually was planned that way from the beginning, but with me in trial, it turned out very well because I didn't have time to make any preparation at all. He had seven countries, if you will, though generally having the names of cities, and one prophecy is to each. I've got one country and seven prophecies. In the next four chapters, all of these next four chapters relate to Egypt. And these four chapters round out the prophecies against the nations. And these, as I say, are devoted entirely to the proclamation of judgment against Egypt. Six of these seven prophecies are explicitly identified by date, although it's very clear that they were delivered at different times in Ezekiel's ministry. I don't know if you had the experience that I had when I started reading through these chapters. I would read and I'd get to a spot and say, who turned the page back? Because if you read through them, you probably picked up on the fact that they're sort of repetitive. And you see the same thing twice in a number of situations through these chapters. And we wonder, well, you know, this is sort of like Cecil getting in the pulpit. And he preaches 6 5-minute sermons, and they're all exactly the same. Why would he do that? Well, he wouldn't. And Ezekiel didn't. Because if you notice the dates, you notice that each one of these prophecies was delivered at different intervals and occasions in Ezekiel's prophecy. And had we been living at that point in time, then the impact of these separate prophecies, even though there is some repetition, would begin to be seen and felt by us as the hearers of Ezekiel. The general background of these prophecies, I think, requires some understanding of the historical relationship between Egypt and Israel. And most of it, I think you're probably familiar with. It began, of course, with the slavery of Israel in Egypt. You can trace the history on back as to when Joseph went to Egypt, I suppose, was the real beginning of it. But the truth of the matter is that at that point in time, there were not many of the Hebrews. And so it was in Egypt that they began to multiply, and over the 430-year captivity that their numbers increased. And this was the beginning, really, of the relationship between these two countries. Ultimately, of course, Israel was led out of Egypt by Moses, and ultimately it became its own state. But Israel always had one problem as its own state, at least in the beginning. Egypt was a very close neighbor, immediately to the south of it. And Egypt was such a large neighbor that Israel could not ignore this very powerful nation to the north. Egypt also had an interest in Israel. And Egypt's interest was to it a very vital geopolitical interest. The principal threat to Egypt always lay to the north. And that's where you would find the Assyrians, the Babylonians. Mesopotamia, and it was from the north that all of these folks ultimately came and threatened Egypt. And Israel's land, the state of Israel, was a buffer zone between Egypt and its enemies on the north. So Egypt was very interested in Israel in order to help it prevent, for lack of a better term, northern aggression, the folks who would come down and seek to conquer Egypt. Over the years in this relationship, Egypt would sometimes be friendly to Israel. But if you go back and look, you discover that when Israel was befriended by Egypt, it was always because Egypt felt that being friendly to Israel was in its own self-interest. In other words, being friendly to it at this point in time, it is in the interest of Egypt, so let's be friendly. On the other hand, sometimes Egypt would be unfriendly to Israel. And when it was unfriendly to Israel, it was always because being unfriendly at that point in time in Egypt's history was in the interest of Egypt. Now, as we said, Israel, compared to its neighbors, and all of these were not neighbors at the same time because we're talking here about a succession of powers. But Israel, in relationship to Egypt and Assyria and Persia, was a very small country. And it was these larger countries that determined whether this little country called Israel was going to be able to retain its independence. Or on the other hand, whether to use a modern illustration, like Switzerland, it was going to become a political settlement, it was going to be a military staging point, or it was going to be some kind of international bargaining point. Now, Switzerland always says, well, we're neutral, we control our own destiny. Not so. It just means that Germany decided it wanted Poland instead of Switzerland. Switzerland did not control its own destiny. It was able to do what it did simply because the other nations and the powers permitted it to do what it did. And that's sort of the way Israel was. And these nations, such as Egypt and Assyria and Persia, could no more be ignored by Israel than a country in, say, Europe or Southeast Asia today can ignore the United States and Russia and China in deciding what its policies are going to be, in deciding how it's going to conduct itself among the family of nations. And it was into this environment that the prophet Ezekiel came. And Ezekiel is at pains, he's very careful to point out that the final say in Israel's destiny was not Israel's. It wasn't even Egypt's or Assyria's or Persia's. The final say in Israel's condition and history and status belonged to God. And God was Israel's God. In other words, Ezekiel is at pains to make these people, Israel and all the other nations, understand that God controlled everything. Now, with that background, let's look at these seven specific prophecies that Ezekiel delivered against Egypt. The first one is found in chapter 29. and the first 16 verses of the chapter. And I've identified it or called it Egypt's Sins Exposed and Judged. It's dated around January the 7th. Some say 588, some say 587. But whichever of those years you pick, the truth is it's just a matter of months before the siege and the eventual destruction of Jerusalem. In the first part of this prophecy, we are introduced to the monster, verses 1 through the first part of the 6th verse. The Pharaoh who is in view here is Pharaoh Hophra, H-O-P-H-R-A. He reigned in Egypt, according to historians, from about 588 to 596 B.C. His grandfather, Pharaoh Necho, N-E-C-O, was the Pharaoh who killed Josiah at Megiddo in 609 B.C. In these verses, this Pharaoh is described as a monster lying among the streams with the Nile as its domain. Monster is a term that you come across, I start to say often, at least occasionally, a number of times in the scripture. And it's translated by various different terms. It's translated monster, as here. It's translated crocodile. It's translated jackal. It's translated serpent. It's translated dragon. But obviously, whichever one of those words you choose, it's talking about some kind of feared creature. And a creature that, by its very nature, has a terrible appearance and a ferocious impact upon those who see it. Probably in this passage, it ought to be translated crocodile, because the crocodile was really the monster of the Nile. And that's why I think it probably should be translated. And that's a crocodile, and that's probably what was in view here. But whatever kind of monster it was, it is described by Ezekiel as being very arrogant. In verse 3, he says, you know, this river is mine. I made it for myself. Now that's pretty arrogant, isn't it? As is so often true with arrogance, the very opposite was the truth. Because the truth was that Pharaoh or Egypt did not make the Nile. The truth was the Nile made Egypt. You know what it was that even made that valley where the greatest part of Egypt lay? What made that valley habitable? Wasn't Egypt. Wasn't Pharaoh. It was the Nile that made it habitable. You know what provided fertile soil for their crops? Egypt didn't cart it in. The Nile brought it in. You know what it was that provided water to irrigate those crops? It was the Nile. You know what it was that provided transportation to get those crops where they needed to be? It was the Nile. What provided water for them to drink? It was the Nile. So Pharaoh did not make the Nile. The Nile made Pharaoh and made Egypt. Without the Nile, there wouldn't have been any Egypt. It was the very heart of Egypt and that which made Egypt. But as an act of judgment, this monster was going to be dragged from the river and left on dry land, and there it was going to become food for the birds of the air. One reason I think it ought to be translated crocodile is the manner in which it's going to be dragged from the river. Hooks in the jaw. And if you go back and read again from historical sources, this was the common method of capturing crocodiles from the Nile, is by hooks in the jaw, and they captured them and dragged them up on dry land. The monster, the scripture says, is going to be left in the desert. And that would mean certain death for the crocodile, of this form of fish that were its food, verse 5. But all of it was for a specific, definite reason and cause. And that's when we get to the first part, the first half of the sixth verse. And that is when the destruction of Egypt becomes a reality. Everybody's going to know that God did it. Then they will know that I am God. Beginning in the second half of the sixth verse and going down through the 16th verse, Ezekiel discusses the judgment that will befall Egypt. In the opening of this section, Ezekiel describes Egypt as a broken or crumpled reed, one that is used as a staff for support. I could have used one of those earlier in this week, but not like this. Because when you leaned on this staff, it shattered. It broke. It provided no assistance or no help. 2 Kings chapter 18 and verse 21, the same description is applied to Egypt. And when the reed broke, there were certain results that followed. When the reed broke, those who were leaning on it had dislocated or broken shoulders. They were not strengthened by its use. They were crippled by its use. And those who leaned on Egypt, Ezekiel says in verses 6 and 7, by implication, as well as his statement here, have basically two choices. Number one, you can stand on your own. But that's probably not viable, or they wouldn't have been trying to lean on Egypt in the first place. Or you can be destroyed. And that's what, as we've already seen, was happening to Jerusalem. Two things are apparent here from what Ezekiel is saying. Egypt was judged by the sword for two reasons. The first reason for which they were judged by the sword was pride. Again in verse 9, it is repeated. Egypt said that the Nile was theirs. They created it. They controlled it. They determined its destiny, in other words. Go back in history. There's probably no more accurate description of Pharaoh Hophra than the word arrogant or prideful. He had a very self-inflated self-image. He was so arrogant that he felt that no one in the world, not anybody's army in the world, could defeat him. He felt so arrogant that he felt the gods of Egypt could not even dislodge him from being king over Egypt. And certainly, if the gods could not do it, no one else could. Now, one thing I'm sure you remember from the lesson last week is that Tyre was punished and destroyed because of its arrogance and pride. It's going to be no different with Egypt. Its pride is going to go before its fall. But the second reason is that Egypt had seduced Israel. Pharaoh Hophra had promised to help Israel against Babylon, against Nebuchadnezzar. We will help you. We will be there when the fight comes. And sure enough, when Nebuchadnezzar came over and laid siege to Jerusalem, here came Pharaoh Hophra, hopping over, to use a little play on his name there, I guess, to see if he could help Israel. And you remember from some of the prior lessons what happened there. Nebuchadnezzar took a day or two off from his siege of Jerusalem and went over and sent Pharaoh Hophra home with his tail between his legs, this man whom no one could defeat, whom not even the gods could dislodge. Nebuchadnezzar did it in short order. I guess it's sort of like the Six Days War, when Egypt decided it would take on Israel, and it took 6 days to teach him a lesson. That it, wasn't something that simple. And Nebuchadnezzar came back and then again returned to the siege of Jerusalem. But the point is that when Nebuchadnezzar went after Pharaoh Hophra, Hophra turned out to be a broken reed. He seduced Israel into the alliance. Be my buffer zone. Protect me from this invasion. I'll be there to back you up. And he turned out to be a broken reed upon whom they could not rely. So as a result of that, God promised to ruin the streams. He said, I'm going to make the land of Egypt uninhabitable for 40 years. I think that's probably not a literal 40 years, but an allusion to a long period of time which the wilderness wandering 40-year period came to stand for. But it's going to be over a long period of time, and I'm going to disperse all of you people out like the Israelites were dispersed. But there will come a time when, in essence, a remnant of the Egyptians will be brought back. But when you are brought back, you will never again walk tall among the nations of the world. You will never again be a nation upon which somebody will rely for anything. Because you're not going to have any ability to deliver anything. And if you promise it, people will just laugh at you. And he identified where they would land at Pathros, verses 13 to 16. You will never be strong again. You will never be listed in the who's who among nations. And if you look at the history of Egypt, you see how very true that prophecy has been. They certainly still exist as a nation, but it's a nation to which people pay very little attention and who really have no impact on the affairs of the world. The oracle against Egypt illustrates, I think, two flaws in character that are commonly the characteristics of individuals as well as nations. The first of these characteristics is delusion. And delusion, I suggest to you, is an offshoot of pride and arrogance. We've discussed the fact that so self-centered had Egypt become that it basically believed that both itself and the river were the products of its own greatness. And this form of national delusion spoke of a type of power that was dangerous in the extreme. And it was a power that could be shattered and would be shattered by an omnipotent God. And those are the words that Ezekiel is declaring here at this point in time. If you stop to think about it, isn't the most dangerous lie in the world the one that deludes the liar as well as others? And isn't that really what happened with Egypt here? Egypt began to believe its own lie, that its strength was its own creation. And isn't this also a characteristic of individuals as well as nations? How many people have we seen in life, none in this room I'm sure, who believe that they are a, quote, self-made man? Now, most folks like that I've met in life, I think, probably are truly self-made men, because I don't think anybody in this world take credit for it. But what you and I need to learn from this is that to the extent we are blessed with any preeminence or prominence in life, it is as a result of the gift of God. It is not, I repeat, it is not, it can never be, must never be, an occasion for pride and arrogance that look what I have done. Because whatever we accomplish in life that is good and right It is accomplished by the power and the gift of God. So, first, Ezekiel's prophecy against Egypt illustrates delusion, an offshoot of pride and arrogance. And the second is selfishness. From time to time, Egypt offered friendship to its neighbor. But as we've suggested, it offered friendship only in an effort to engineer its own benefit and for its own good. What does that mean? It means that there was a false friendship there. It means that it was a false friendship that was very hastily withdrawn whenever that friendship began to cost them something. And that's the worst kind of friendship. It undermines the entire fabric of national relations. It undermines the entire fabric of human relations. And according to Ezekiel, it is the type of conduct that invites the judgment of God. And why should we think that it's only when nations do it that it invites the judgment of God? Why doesn't it do it when, as individuals, we conduct ourselves in that manner and we withdraw our friendship when it begins to cost us something? There's no reason at all to distinguish between the two. And the reason for that is that friendship is fundamental to all human relations. Whether we're talking about nations or individuals, it is the thing that hangs groups of people together. It's the thing that hangs nations together. And it can only be strong and right when it is engendered in a spirit of self-sacrifice. In other words, the friendship that is willing to take, but is not willing to give, is not true friendship at all. There's no greater insight into the type of friendship that is necessary in this world than the description given by Jesus in John 15:13. Greater love hath no man than this, that he lay down his life for his friend. True friendship must eliminate the power of selfishness and must be built upon the power of selflessness. Ezekiel is pointing those lessons out to us in his prophecy against Egypt, oracle or prophecy number 2. Chapter 29, verses 17 to 21. Dated New Year's Day, around 571 B.C. And New Year's Day, by the way, was Jewish New Year's Day, which occurred around April the 26th. And this is some 16 years after the first oracle. Now, that goes to the repetition comment I made in the opening. Everybody can remember what Cecil preached on 16 years ago today? Raise your hand. Better put mine down. I'm confident they probably had forgotten it by then, although Ezekiel's prophecies would be hard to overlook. Here in this prophecy, Ezekiel is telling the Egyptians that Egypt is going to suffer the fate of Tyre. Nebuchadnezzar campaigned against Tyre for 13 years and came away without a final victory. Now, he came away with somewhat of a victory because, to an extent, Tyre became a vassal state and paid some homage to Babylonia and to Nebuchadnezzar. But he never really fully subjugated Tyre. Remember Eric's lesson of 2 or 3 Sundays ago. People would come along and they could take care of most of Tyre, but the island fortress, nobody ever captured until Alexander the Great came along and pulled the task off. It was no different with Nebuchadnezzar here. And the scripture describes very graphically what Nebuchadnezzar got for his trouble in his 13-year siege. I think it's verse 18. And let me say in advance, I was not at the siege of Tyre. They got bald heads and chapped shoulders. Shoulders that were chapped raw. And this basically is a very graphic description of what happens when you're a soldier there in that siege against Tyre and you've worn your helmet for 13 years. Gerald Ford, they say, played too much football without a helmet. These soldiers wore their helmets too long. And they carried all of the materials that they went, you know, to build the siege works with on their shoulders. And their shoulders were just worn raw from carrying all of those materials to build the siege works. And in this message, oh, what a description of Egypt it is. Egypt the mighty. Egypt the great. Egypt the wonderful. Egypt the builder of itself. Hophra the Pharaoh who could not be defeated by any man's army or even Egypt's own gods. God says, I'm going to give Egypt to Nebuchadnezzar as a consolation prize. That's what Egypt was in the mind of God. The loot and plunder that Nebuchadnezzar would take in his battle against Egypt was something that God was bringing about. It was divinely motivated, if I may use that expression. Look down at verse 20. And the reason is given, because they wrought for me. Nebuchadnezzar's men came away from Tyre with nothing to show for 13 years. What happened to the riches of Tyre, we do not know. Some suggest that they were taken away by sea from the far side of the island fortress. Some suggest that they were all expended in defense costs. But whatever it was, when Nebuchadnezzar ended his 13-year battle against Tyre, he went away empty-handed and his soldiers went away unpaid. Now here comes Egypt. You want your pay, soldiers? Here's where you are going to get it. They were disappointed over Tyre. But Ezekiel declares that Nebuchadnezzar would be given the opportunity of plundering Egypt and carrying off its wealth as compensation for the fruitless work in the long siege of Tyre. We don't know very much about how that came about, but apparently it occurred a few years later, sometime around 568, 567 B.C., at which time it's presumed that Pharaoh Amasis II came to terms with the invading army by paying massive tribute to Nebuchadnezzar. This oracle concludes with an element of hope. A horn, we are told, would spring forth unto Israel, indicating a new life and a new hope. What is the horn? Some suggest that it's a messianic statement. And certainly it is true that the Messiah in Old Testament scriptures is sometimes referred to as a horn. Look at Psalm 132 and verse 17. But I suggest to you that the language in Ezekiel chapter 29 does not demand that this be understood in the messianic sense. Some suggest that it's simply a reference to Egypt's or to Israel's future restoration. And that is possible. But the context again does not demand it. Some suggest that Nebuchadnezzar may himself be the horn to bud forth unto the house of Israel, in that he would now work for Israel against her enemy Egypt, as he had worked for God against Tyre. And given the context, and given that if you find the meaning there, it's probably best not to look beyond that's sort of where I wind up. But again, it's I'm not dogmatic about that. At the same time, Ezekiel's mouth is going to be open to speak with greater confidence. Some say, well, you remember that Ezekiel had what we refer to as a ritual dumbness. And that was to last, according to Scripture, until a particular time. And if you go back and read the passages in Ezekiel that tell you about that time, then you understand that this cannot be a reference to his ritual dumbness. Because the Scripture said that that dumbness was to last until the day the messenger came to tell Ezekiel about the downfall of Jerusalem. Chapter 24, verse 27. And if you move forward just a little bit in the book of Ezekiel, and remembering how Ezekiel is arranged, you're actually moving backward a bit in time, chapter 33 and verse 22, that person had already come by this time. So if it is not a reference to the ritual dumbness that God imposed upon Ezekiel from the death of his wife to the time that the messenger came, telling about the destruction of Jerusalem, to what does it refer? And I think probably the best answer is it seems to be a reference to the authentication of Ezekiel's prophecy through fulfillment. His prophecies speak and live in what is happening here and demonstrate that he is indeed a prophet of God and demonstrate that the God of Israel is in fact the only true and living God. Now, Eric is probably beginning to sweat some bullets right now because I've got one Sunday now to cover three chapters. But I think we can do that without any trouble. So I will put him at ease and put y'all at ease. Because as I say, there's some repetition here, and I think when we get to these later chapters, we can move through them more quickly. But I hope by being a little more thorough in chapter 29, we have laid some foundation that will help you to understand more about these prophecies that we're reading right now, these oracles against Egypt, in chapters 29, 30, 31, and 32. And for next Lord's Day, let me encourage you to go back and read 30, 31, and 32 again in light of our discussion today. And I think you'll find that they'll be more meaningful to you as you read through them this time. And next Lord's Day, we'll cover these final three chapters, and we may cover some of them pretty quickly, but we will finish next Lord's Day. Thank you for your presence and your attention.